in here.
He offered up a self-deprecating laugh and a smile.
The fact is, he said, I love New York.
How dare she say those things to you?
Estelle Clements said when her husband returned to the TV studio's green room, where guests waited for their turn to go on air. There was a monitor in the room, and she had watched the segment. She lowered her voice and said,
What a bitch.
Clements scowled.
The way she talked to me,
he said, his voice trailing off as he grabbed her by the arm and steered her into the hallway.
You're hurting me, she said.
He eased his grip but did not let go of her as they headed for the lobby.
You should sue, Estelle said. You could sue her for what she said.
The studio was on the fourth floor of a building on Columbus Circle. There were several people waiting at the bank of elevators by the reception desk. Clement said,
Let's take the stairs. Do we have... I just want to get out of here as fast as I can,
he said, already leading her toward a door with an exit sign over it. Estelle, sensing his anger, did not object. When they came out onto the street, Clement stopped for a moment to compose himself.
Did you hear what I said up there? Estelle asked. You should sue her and the network for...
No, he said firmly. It's more than just one arrogant TV host or one network. It's a bigger battle than that.
Estelle placed a hand on his arm.
What do you want to do? Do you want to go home? We can, you know. If this has ruined everything, we don't have to stay. I can see if I can get our money back on the tickets.
Tickets? He said.
You remember we have tickets for that show tonight, but it's okay. We can...
No, we're going.
He lifted his head and gave it a small shake, as though trying to rid himself of the anger he felt. Then he forced his mouth into a smile.
We're not going to let them stop us from having a good time.
Estelle smiled.
You're sure?
Clement nodded.
I'd forgotten about the show. What are we seeing?
It's that one with all the dancing, Estelle said. I know that doesn't exactly narrow it down. You're probably going to hate it anyway.
All those Nancy boys prancing about the stage? I wouldn't miss it for the world. In the meantime, I'm going to take you out for a fabulous lunch. How does the Capitol Grill sound?
Sure,
his wife said.
I'll get us a cab, he said. You stay here.
He stepped off the sidewalk and walked out between two parked cars. He came up around the side of one of them as he waved his hand in the air. Behind him, he heard a window power down.
Hey,
someone said. Eugene Clement did not turn around when he heard Bucky's voice. Looking up the street, Clement said,
Still on track?
Yes.
Keep your eyes open. The world knows I'm here. There's probably a heightened alert already.
Got it.
We're good to go.
Clement heard the window power up as a yellow cab swerved across the street and came to a stop in front of him. Clement opened the back door and called out to his wife.
Madam,
he said,
your chariot has arrived.
23. Barbara had been in the funeral home for the better part of half an hour. Chris Valens was getting tired of waiting across the street for her to come out. It wasn't hard to figure out why she might be here, given that in her column she'd written about losing a friend in the Monday elevator accident. The dead woman's name had been Paula Chatsworth. To confirm, he had looked up this funeral home on his phone and called to ask if the Chatsworth service would be held there. And if so, when? Asking for a friend, he said. The woman who answered said that while the home had been involved, the service for the Chatsworth woman was going to be held up in Montpelier.
Ah, well, thank you very much, he said.
Chris believed he was going to have to do more than just follow Barbara Matheson around and make a few online inquiries. If you really wanted to find the dirt on someone, you broke into their place. You got on their computer and read their emails. You looked into the bottom bedroom dresser drawer and checked out the sex toys. But one thing had come out of today's efforts that had piqued his curiosity. Who was the woman Barbara had met with at the Morning Star? They hadn't talked long. The other woman hadn't even ordered breakfast. Was she a source? Was she someone passing along information to Barbara? Valens could not recall seeing the woman in the time he had been working for the mayor's office, but the city employed a lot of people who could be privy to the kind of information Barbara would like to have. Even though Chris had seen her from across the street, he was confident he'd recognize the woman if he saw her again. And he had her picture. Valens started hearing music and glanced to the north. A shabbily dressed man was coming his way, pushing a rickety shopping cart with nothing in it but an 80s-style boombox that was playing at full volume. You can't always get what you want. Wasn't that the truth, Valens thought, giving the man a nod as he wheeled his cart past him. The man was bobbing his head to the music and took one hand off the cart's handle long enough to give Valens a thumbs up. Valens couldn't help but smile. Finally, Barbara emerged from the funeral home and started walking back toward Second Avenue. Valens was on the move again. When the Manhattan Today writer got to the corner, she crossed 27th, looking down at the phone in her hand the entire time. A cab shot past, the driver giving her the horn. Without even looking up, Barbara sent her free hand skyward and gave the cabbie the finger. She went into the Duane Reade on the corner. Chris followed her in, still keeping his distance, and found that Barbara had gone down the feminine hygiene products aisle. He knew he was going to look especially conspicuous hanging around that part of the store, so he decided to go back outside and wait for her to emerge. He found a spot a few yards down the sidewalk where he could watch the door of the drugstore. While he waited, his own phone rang. He dug it out of his jacket, saw Valerie on the screen. "Yeah," he said.
"Where the hell are you?" Valerie asked.
"I'm running an errand for the mayor."
"What kind of errand?"
"If he wanted you to know, I'm guessing he would have told you." A sigh at the other end. Then,
"There's been another elevator plunge."
"You're shitting me."
"No."
"Where?"
"On York, just south of Rockefeller University, some big deal Russian scientist got killed."
"Jesus," Chris said. "Are you there?"
"Yeah. Homeland Security's here, too."
"What?"
"Yeah. Maybe because of who it was who got killed. You ever heard of Fenya Petrov?"
"No. Should I?"
"Beats me."
Barbara, a small Duane Reade bag in hand, came out of the store. She glanced into the bag as if checking that she remembered everything. "I gotta go," Chris told Valerie. Without waiting for a response, he ended the call and slipped the phone back into his jacket. Barbara was heading north, holding the bag in her left hand, her phone in her right. As she crossed 28th Street, she put the phone to her ear, spoke to someone. The call lasted little more than 30 seconds, which led Chris to think maybe she'd only left a voicemail. As she continued on, she appeared to be searching for something on her phone. Maybe another number, someone else she wanted to get in touch with. Or maybe she was on some site thumbing through headlines. She did write a column, after all, Chris thought, making an allowance for how she never put the phone away. She probably read through several dozen news sites every day. And then she'd be calling people and interviewing them and turning the shit they said into a piece for Manhattan Today. But right now, in the wake of what she had written lately about the mayor, it would be nice to know exactly what she was reading and who she might be getting in touch with. And why had she gone to the funeral home anyway? Was it simply to offer condolences, or was there more to it than that? Chris found himself closing the distance between himself and Barbara, fooling himself into thinking that if he got near enough, he'd be able to see what was on her phone before she put it away or to her ear. Chris had an astounding number of talents, skills that no one even knew about, but there were limits to what he could do. Between 30th and 31st, Barbara nearly walked into an elderly woman coming in the other direction. Her bat-like radar had her dodging out of the way just in time. As they neared 32nd Street, Chris started to worry. If Barbara had been looking up as she approached the intersection on the west side of 2nd, she might have noticed the "don't walk" warning blazing from the traffic signal on the other side. But Barbara, oblivious, kept on walking. Coming from the left, A once white van, nearly eaten away by rust, was approaching at high speed. It careened around a taxi that had pulled over to pick up a fare. The driver was flooring it, hoping to make it across second before the light turned red. The engine roared hoarsely as if suffering from automotive emphysema. Barbara stepped off the sidewalk and into the intersection. Everything happened in milliseconds. Chris expected Barbara's seemingly innate sense of where she was and what was going on around her to kick in. As the truck bore down on her, Chris realized with startling clarity that was not going to happen. Fuck, he thought. 24. When Jerry Burke and Lois Delgado finished talking to Gunther Willem, manager of Simpson Elevator, they went into the back shop to talk to the other employees. The company, counting Willem and the woman in the office, had 9. 8, now that Petrenko was going to be removed from the payroll. 4 more were on the premises, 2 were out on a call together. Burke and Delgado split them up, each interviewing 2 men. All 4 were asked further questions about the dead man, whether they had noticed anything out of the ordinary with him in recent weeks, whether he seemed on edge, worried about anything. Did Petrenko have any vices he kept secret from his wife? Did he gamble? Did he use drugs? Was he seeing anyone on the side? Did he frequent prostitutes? And finally, who was the man who'd come to visit him? The one he went out onto the street to talk to? None of the 4 claimed to have seen Petrenko talking to the mystery man. The 2 employees not on site were on a call at a 12-story apartment building on Claremont Avenue in Brooklyn, just south of the Brooklyn Navy Yard. Delgado drove. They parked on the street and buzzed the superintendent when they entered the lobby. The building's 2 elevators were out of commission during the servicing, and the 2 technicians from Simpson Elevator were on the 12th floor.
Can they get one going?
Burke asked. The super said,
I told them, can you do one at a time? But no, they shut them both down at once. Everyone in the building is complaining.
No problem, Delgado said. We'll take the stairs. A wave of anxiety washed over Burke. His lungs felt absolutely fine. He hadn't taken a hit off his inhaler yet today. Climbing 11 flights of stairs shouldn't have been a problem for him. A few months ago, he might have taken half those flights 2 steps at a time. But that was before. Could he make it to the 12th floor? What if his airways started to constrict along the way? And Burke had been dealing with this issue long enough to know that just worrying about an attack was enough to bring one on.
I'll be fine, he told himself. I can do this, just don't think.
It was like, Burke realized, when someone told you not to think about an elephant, Dumbo popped into your head. So when Burke told himself,
don't think about the drops,
he thought about the drops. You coming? Delgado said to her partner.
Right behind you, he said.
It hit him by the 4th floor. His windpipe started to shrink down to the size of a straw. When they were nearly to the 5th, Burke called up to Delgado, who was half a dozen steps ahead.
I just got a text.
Delgado glanced back, stopped.
Just go on. I'll catch up,
he said, taking the phone from his jacket, looking at the screen and nodding as if to confirm he was right about receiving a message. What is it? Delgado asked.
I got it,
Burke said dismissively. Delgado climbed on. Once she'd made a turn in the stairwell and was out of sight, Burke put the phone back into his jacket. He gripped the railing with one hand to steady himself, then dug into his pocket with the other and came out with his inhaler. But before wrapping his mouth around it, he decided to give his doctor's advice one more try.
Focus.
What had he suggested? Focus on 5 things you see, 5 things you hear.
I'm in a fucking concrete stairwell. There aren't 5 things to see or 5 things to hear.
That was okay. He could wing it. Like, think of 5 Paul Newman movies. There was The Sting, Cool Hand Luke, Harper. That was 3. Oh, and The Verdict. and that one where he was the pool hustler. What the hell was that one called? Weren't there actually two? There was the original, that was... Fuck. The Hustler. A movie about a pool hustler might just be called The Hustler. But then 25 years later, he reprised the character in a movie with Tom Cruise, had color in the title. What the hell was that one? He was still wheezing. From a couple of floors above, Delgado's voice echoed, "You okay down there?"
"Yeah,"
he managed to shout.
"Coming."
The hell with it. He exhaled, put the puffer between his lips, squeezed it, and drew the medicated mist deep into his lungs. Keeping his lips sealed, he did a mental count to 10, then exhaled. He repeated the process, then slipped the inhaler back into his pocket. Christ, it was all he could do to hold his breath for 10 seconds. You watch these movies where James Bond is rescuing someone underwater for minutes at a time without coming up for air. How the hell was that even possible? Plenty of takes. That was how. Burke felt his windpipe enlarging, his lungs filling with the stale air of the stairwell. Time to move on. He caught up with his partner at the 10th floor. Even she had stopped to catch her breath, and Burke took pleasure in overtaking her.
"Haven't got all day," he said.
"Bite me," Delgado said. They came out onto the 12th floor, and at the hallway's end, directly in front of an open elevator door, were two men on their knees, huddled over a large toolbox. One was white, thin, probably mid-40s. The other was black, heavyset, late 20s. Even from the end of the hallway, the detectives could tell that there was no elevator car beyond the opening. What they could see was the cinder block back wall of the shaft and various vertical cables.
"Hey,"
Burke said. The black one turned, then said to his partner,
"Cops are here."
The two men stood. Burke and Delgado showed their badges and offered hands to shake, but the repairman begged off, displaying oily, greasy palms.
"I'm Walter," the older man said. "This is Terrence."
Terrence nodded.
"They told us you were coming."
"So you know what this is about?" Delgado said.
"Can't believe Otto's dead," Walter said. "Jesus, you do what we do for a living. You figure if you're gonna go, it'll probably be because you went through an open door by mistake."
At which point he nodded toward the elevator shaft.
"Yeah,"
said Terrence, and then gesturing toward his coworker, "well, some moron knocks you in."
"What happened to him?"
Walter asked. Burke did the usual dance of not answering and asked the two men the same questions he and Delgado had asked the others. Had they noticed anything odd about Otto in recent weeks? They had not. Had they seen the man who'd dropped by to see him at Simpson Elevator? Again, they both shook their heads.
"Why?"
asked Walter.
"You think this guy did something to Otto?"
"We'd like to talk to him," Delgado said.
Terrence said,
"Hang on."
"What?" Delgado asked. He dug a rag out of his pocket and started to wipe off his hands.
"So, I've been wanting to buy a car. Like, I always liked Mustangs, so I've been going through the online ads, you know, seeing if someone has a decent used one, because no way I can afford a new one. And I'm not totally nuts about the latest design anyway. I kind of like the ones from around 2005, 2006, you know?"
"Okay," said Burke.
"So I find one in Queens, and I call the guy. It's a 2005, and he's asking about $3,500 for it. And I tell him I want to have a look at it, but I'm kind of busy, and he says, 'Where do you work? I could run it by. You could check it out,' which makes the guy sound a bit desperate, so I'm thinking he might take a lowball offer, so I say okay. So he comes over, this is like 2 weeks ago, parks it at the curb, and I come out to have a look at it."
Walter said,
"Terrence here takes a long time to get to the point."
"That's okay," Burke said.
His hands cleared of the worst of the grease, he pulled a phone from his pocket and tapped on the photos icon.
"I wanted to take a few pictures of it from all angles. Told the guy I wasn't ready to make up my mind, but having some shots to refresh my memory later would be a good idea. So, like, here's the shots."
He held the camera in front of the detectives and swiped through the pictures. Many of them were close-ups of parts of the blue car, including one of the rear wheel well.
"A lot of rust there. I could probably fix it myself. But if I made a big deal about it, he'd probably come down a bit more. Okay, here's the one I was thinking of."
The photo he'd landed on was a full shot of the car parked on the street.
So, if you look back here, that's Otto,
he said, on the sidewalk.
May I? Burke asked, holding out his hand. Terrence gave him the phone. With his index finger and thumb, Burke enlarged the photo, zeroing in on the background. There was another car beyond the Mustang, a plain, dark sedan. One man was leaning against it, arms folded, talking to Otto, perched on the curb. The man was white, maybe 6 feet, gray hair. He looked to be wearing a suit, but the bigger Burke made the picture, the less distinct it became. What about the car? Delgado asked. Burke shifted the focus to the car. The Mustang in the foreground cut off the left half of the orangey-yellow plate, and the part that could be seen was blurry.
New York plate, Burke said.
That narrows it down, Delgado said.
Last two numbers, 1 and 3.
Maybe. Burke tapped the screen a couple of times.
Just want to know when this was taken, he squinted. Here we go. This looks like
middle of last month, the 15th. That sounds right, Terrence said. Burke said,
I'm going to email this to myself.
Sure, yeah, okay. Burke did a few more taps, then hit send. Seconds later, there was a familiar ding from his jacket pocket. Terrence had never gotten a closer look at Otto's friend and had never learned anything about him, same with Walter.
Did you buy the Mustang? Burke asked.
Terrence grinned.
I did. Got it for $2,000.
Delgado asked, pointing toward the open door.
What's wrong with the elevator?
Walter shrugged.
Just routine maintenance.
Delgado took a step closer, stuck her head beyond the door's edge, and peered down the shaft. 12 floors down to the bottom. The car was 12 floors down, at the bottom.
Yikes, she said.
Walter chuckled.
That's nothing. Coming to Manhattan sometime. You look down, you think you can see all the way to hell.
When they returned to their car, Delgado got behind the wheel of their unmarked cruiser, waited until Burke was settled in beside her, then got out her phone. She began tapping at the screen.
What?
Burke said.
Hang on, she said.
Her phone made a brief whoop sound. She'd sent a text. Before Burke could quiz her again, he heard the ding of an incoming text on his own phone. He reached into his jacket, saw the one-word message from Delgado.
Hi.
He looked from his phone to her.
I heard that one, she said. Funny I didn't hear the other two, in the stairwell or on the high line.
She put the car in drive and hit the gas. 25. Save her or not save her? It was incredible how many thoughts could go through one's head so quickly. But even in the fraction of a second that Chris Valens had to make a decision, he realized what he had here was an opportunity. As that truck bore down on Barbara, whose eyes were still focused on her damn phone, Chris saw that a solution to the mayor's problem had presented itself. In a millisecond, this walking, talking, writing thorn in the mayor's paw could be dead. A gift has been handed to us. Some gifts, it turned out, were more difficult to accept than others. He darted into the street like an Olympic runner who'd just heard the shot from a starter's pistol. His left arm went into the air, palm facing the truck, as if he were Superman and could stop its progress. Even if he could have, the truck swerved. Barbara looked up from her phone. Her head turned a couple of degrees in the direction of the truck, but there wasn't time for her to get a full view of it. Chris had thrown his right arm around her waist. He was moving so quickly that she was literally swept off her feet, and then basically thrown. It was, pretty much, a football tackle. Barbara went down, hitting the pavement just shy of the opposite corner. Chris went down with her, the knuckles of his right hand scraping the pavement, tearing his glove. Barbara let out a scream as her right elbow hit asphalt, but it was drowned out by the brake squeal and the subsequent gunning of the engine from the truck. It sped through the intersection. The driver, knowing that at least he hadn't killed anyone,
evidently saw no reason to hang around. Barbara's phone slipped from her hand and skittered across the pavement, bouncing off the curb. Her Duane Reade bag was airborne. When it landed some 20 feet away, its contents, a box of Tampax, a stick of Hall's lemon cough candies, and a bottle of shampoo, scattered across the pavement.
Shit!
She cried. Instead of trying to get up, she rolled over onto her back. She winced as she gripped her elbow.
Fuck!
Chris had hit the ground hard, too, but at least he knew what was coming and had thrown himself into a roll as he struck pavement. As he slowly got to his feet, half a dozen people gathered. An elderly woman who'd gone to fetch Barbara's phone glanced at Chris and said,
"Well done!"
As she stood over Barbara, ready to hand her the phone, she asked Barbara,
"Do you need an ambulance?"
I think I'm okay," Barbara said. "It just hurts like a motherfucker is all."
Chris watched Barbara, working her arm, tried to determine whether her elbow was broken. She could move it without screaming, so that was a good sign. He was pretty sure, despite the close contact he'd had with Barbara, she'd not actually seen him. She didn't know who had pulled her from the van's path. The identity of her Good Samaritan could remain a mystery. Perfect. All he had to do was walk away, blend in with others on the sidewalk. He started heading north.
Hey!
Chris was pretty sure who was doing the yelling and who was being yelled at.
You! With the hat!
Chris pulled the ball cap lower onto his forehead and slowly turned. Barbara had gotten to a standing position. The old woman had moved on, but a young man in a U.S. Postal Service uniform and a short, round-shouldered woman with a wheeled wire cart full of groceries were on either side of her offering support. Someone had gathered her Duane Reade purchases and put them back in the bag. Barbara, now standing on her own, was staring at him. Chris slowly pointed a finger to his own chest, pretending to be puzzled.
Yeah, you,
she said, pointing.
Jesus, you play for the Jets?
She's going to recognize me. Get ahead of this. Don't let her be the one. He took a step toward her, let his jaw drop with feigned astonishment.
Christ, it's you, he said.
Barbara blinked a couple of times as though trying to focus.
What?
He took off the hat. I was in the limo. Yesterday, I work for the mayor. Barbara's astonishment appeared 100% genuine.
I don't believe it. It is you, Chris something.
Valens, he said, moving in closer. He looked at the man and woman flanking her. It's okay, he said. I got this. They nodded with relief that they didn't have to hang around.
What the hell were you doing walking off? You fucking saved my life!
He shrugged. You looked okay, so I didn't think I was needed. Are you okay?
I think so, but my elbow hurts like a son of a bitch.
You should get it checked out. You should go to the hospital.
I've had enough of hospitals, she said. I just need to put some ice on it.
Chris appeared to be considering something. Look, he said. My place is only a couple of blocks from here. And if I don't have ice, I've probably got some frozen dinners that'd do the trick. She eyed him warily.
How'd you do it?
She asked. It was a simple tackle. Nothing to it.
No, not that. Was the guy driving the van in on it? He waited until I got there and you were in position?
He met her skeptical eyes with his. You figured it out. I come from a long line of conspirators. My dad helped fake the moon landing. You want some fucking ice for your elbow or not? 26. Mayor Headley followed Brian Cartland of Homeland Security, NYPD Chief Annette Washington, and Martin Fleck from the city department that oversaw elevator operations to a stairwell. The fire chief, who'd evidently been up here earlier with Fleck, had stayed in the lobby. Headley had been worried they were heading all the way up to the hallway where they'd find the rest of Fanya Petrov. But it turned out
that for now they were going only as far as the second floor. They came out onto a hallway and approached the four elevators. Only one had the doors in the open position. A police officer was standing guard, keeping people away, because there was no elevator car beyond the opening. At least, not one that anyone could step into. But someone could step onto it. Given that the car was one floor below, at lobby level, what the mayor and others were looking at was the roof of the elevator car. Two large steel beams ran crossways, left to right, across the top of the middle of the car. Attached to it were various cables and metal boxes with large buttons on them. More cables, electrical ones, were snaked neatly across the top of the car. In the far left corner was what appeared to be a hatch. Headley pointed. "That's where people can get out."
"They can be rescued from there," Fleck said. "But it's not like in the movies where you see passengers pushing it aside and getting out themselves. It's locked. It can only be opened by rescue workers."
Headley pointed tentatively into the shaft.
"Can I poke my head in there?"
Fleck nodded. The mayor stood at the edge, braced himself with one hand at where the door slid into the wall, and leaned in. He craned his neck around to look up. The shaft's four corners appeared to disappear into infinity.
"Christ," he said,
and pulled himself back into the hallway.
"So what did you want to show me?"
Cartland pointed to something close to the hatch.
"You see that?"
Headley squinted.
"What?"
Cartland looked at Fleck.
"Can you help us here?"
Fleck stepped from the hallway directly onto the roof of the elevator. Headley was the only one to give a short gasp, but the elevator was as solid under Fleck's feet as if he were standing in the lobby. He lifted his leg over the beam to get closer to the far side of the car's roof. He knelt down and indicated, without touching it, a small black box not much bigger than a cell phone, but thicker, that had a short black wand attached.
"This is an antenna," Fleck said. "And this," he said, pointing to the box, "is a remote pinhole camera."
Headley watched.
"Go on." "Someone's drilled a small hole here that provides a view of what's happening inside the car."
Fleck stood, used one of the beams to lean against. He looked as relaxed as if he were sitting on a park bench.
"Cameras in an elevator don't seem all that unusual," Headley said.
Fleck said, "People think cameras are everywhere, but that's not necessarily so with elevators. There may be cameras in the hallways and the lobbies, so you see who's going in and out of the elevators. But while they're inside, not so much. Freight elevators, that's a different story sometimes. Security likes to keep tabs on those."
"But some buildings must have cameras in the regular elevators," the mayor said.
"You're right," Fleck said. "But we've talked to building management. They don't have them here." "The other elevators? No cameras in those."
Headley looked at the man from Homeland Security and the police chief. Their faces were grim.
"Only this one," Cartland said for emphasis.
"Well, and one other."
Headley waited. "We had a look at the elevator from yesterday. There was a camera attached to the roof of that car, too, like this one. It was the only elevator in the building outfitted that way."
"Jesus Christ,"
Headley said.
"We have a definite link between both events," Annette Washington said. "Same kind of camera, identical placement."
"What you're telling me," Headley said, "is that somebody could have been watching everything that happened. Somebody could have watched those people die yesterday. Somebody could have watched that scientist's head come off."
No one said anything.
"Fucking hell," Headley said.
He pointed first to the camera, then to the beams and other equipment that sat atop the elevator car.
"Fingerprints?"
"Working on it,"
Washington said.
"And what about surveillance cameras in the halls and the lobby?"
Cartland said, "We don't know when this camera might have been placed here. It could have been a week ago, a month ago, or a year. Fleck here is going to have to go back and see when this elevator was last inspected. It's doubtful this would have been overlooked during an inspection. That'd mean it was outfitted with the camera since then." He sighed.
We don't know how far ahead this was planned. Fleck said,
My experience, someone walks in wearing maintenance coveralls and a hard hat, he can pretty much get into any part of a building he wants.
This is unbelievable,
Headley said. He turned on Fleck.
It's your fucking department! Aren't your people looking for this kind of thing?
Fleck didn't flinch.
No, we're looking for mechanical and safety problems, although, like Mr. Cartland said, I'd like to think that our people would have noticed this.
Headley tried to stare him down.
Like to think?
Cartland cleared his throat. If you've got the strength to walk up a few more floors, Fleck got something else to show you. Headley trembled at the thought of having to look at the headless corpse. Surely they didn't need for him to see that.
If you're asking me to see what's left of Dr. Petrov up there, you can spare me the trouble, Headley asked. Is her body still up there?
Cartland nodded gravely.
Seeing her head was enough, the mayor said.
Fleck threw his leg back over the beam, got himself off the roof and back into the hallway. He dusted himself off and then looked at the mayor.
That's not what we want you to have a look at,
he said.
What then? As bad as what you've seen so far,
he said.
It gets worse.
27. Driving back into Manhattan, looking straight ahead as she drove over the Queensboro Bridge, Lois Delgado said,
So talk to me.
Jerry Burke said,
Talk to you about what?
She glanced his way.
What's with the texts that aren't texts? I've got ears, you know. If someone had sent you a text, I'd have heard it.
Burke ignored her. Watched the traffic.
You can't breathe, she said. You're sneaking puffs on that thing.
Now Burke shot her a look.
What?
She said.
What kind of detective would I be if I hadn't noticed?
Burke, looking away, said,
I use it the odd time.
She sighed.
It's not allergies or bronchitis or anything like that, is it? If it was, you wouldn't be hiding it. It's in your head, right?
Before he could reply, she said,
Shit. It's not like cancer, is it? Emphysema? I've never seen you smoke.
I don't have cancer and I don't have emphysema.
So it's the other thing.
Burke said nothing.
Maybe you came back too soon.
I took 2 weeks. I was fine. I could have taken 2 years. It wouldn't have made any difference.
Delgado said,
You don't know that. What happened to you? That kind of shit can mess you up. There's no shame in not coming back until you're ready.
She decided not to push and drove a few more blocks without saying anything except for one fucking asshole when a cab cut her off.
The doctor says there's nothing physiological,
Burke finally said.
Okay.
It's like you say. It's a reaction to stress.
She nodded.
So, at those times, your windpipe starts shrinking on you?
He nodded. More or less. Couple hits off the inhaler usually takes care of it. Until the next time.
And this has been going on since it happened?
Burke shook his head. No. Maybe 3-4 months after. I've been having a lot of trouble sleeping. And when I did finally nod off, there were nightmares. And then, through the day, there'd be times when I found myself struggling to catch my breath. The memory gets triggered and it starts.
You can't blame yourself,
Delgado said.
It wasn't your fault. Is that what this is about? Guilt? Because you didn't do anything different than I would have done.
Tell that to the kid,
Burke said.
You know, and I know, the only person who gets the blame is Blair Evans. What were you supposed to do? Stand there and let him shoot you? There was a review. You did nothing wrong.
I should have taken the bullet. He might have missed anything vital.
Listen to you. More likely, he would have put it right between your eyes.
Burke's voice went low.
I should have been ready. I was going for my weapon, but I wasn't fast enough.
Well, the son of a bitch got what was coming to him anyway. Running into traffic right in front of a double-decker tour bus. Wham! Look, you're going by the Waldorf when you hear a shot.
this Evans asshole comes running out the front, armed, before you've even got a chance to react. You yell freeze, he's aiming right for you, he pulls the trigger, and you dive out of the way. Exactly what I would have done.
I didn't know she was behind me, he said so quietly that she almost didn't hear him.
How could you, Jerry? You got eyes in the back of your head? If it hadn't been her, that bullet would have kept heading up Park Avenue until it found someone.
Her name was Sasha.
Delgado nodded.
I know.
And her baby's name is Amanda.
I know that too.
Burke's voice went even quieter. There were drops of blood on Amanda's face. She's in a baby carriage, on her back. She's looking up. Imagine being 14 months old and seeing your mother take a bullet through the head, tasting her blood as the drops land on your lips.
Delgado could find no words. It's the drops I see, Burke said. Whenever I close my eyes, I see the drops.
You should talk to someone.
Burke looked at his partner. I'm talking to you.
And when he breathed in, they both heard a whistle.
Oh, shit, he said.
He took his inhaler from his pocket and uncapped it. Before he could put it to his mouth, it slipped from his fingers and landed in the footwell in front of him.
Damn thing slips out of my hand half the time, he said.
The inhaler was beyond his reach. He briefly unbuckled his seatbelt so he could shift forward to scoop it up. He took a couple of hits from it before tucking it back into his jacket.
If you didn't have that thing, what would happen?
Delgado asked.
Ask my doctor the same question, Burke said.
He never really gave me an answer.
28. Chris Valens said to Barbara Matheson, here. He'd stopped in front of the doors to a plain white brick apartment building on the south side of East 29th Street between 2nd and 3rd. My place, he said. Sitting on the sidewalk, his back supported by the apartment building, was an unshaven man in his 40s or 50s, a paper coffee cup on the ground in front of him with a few coins in it. His clothes were worn and dirty, but he was wearing a blue pullover sweater that looked relatively new. Hey, Chris said to the man, who gave every indication of being homeless. He looked at Chris and smiled.
My man, he said. How's it going?
Not bad, Chris said. You?
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, he sang. A beautiful day for a neighbor. Will you be mine?
Chris grinned. How's the sweater working out? The man gripped the front of the sweater, gave it a tug, then let go.
Mighty fine. Nice to have when there's no room at the inn overnight. Got any more?
I'll look through my closet again. In the meantime, Chris said, taking off his gloves, you might as well have these. The leather on the fingers of the right glove was torn in several places from when Chris had hit the pavement.
No, I couldn't,
the man said, but reached up anyway to take them. The right one's a bit ripped up, I'm afraid. Valens glanced at his bruised knuckles. Me too, apparently. Barbara looked at Valens's hand.
I'm sorry, that's because of me.
Valens shrugged, his attention still focused on the homeless man, who was already trying the gloves on for size. They fit? The homeless man grinned and said,
not bad. Got a receipt in case I need to return them?
Think I lost it, Valens said. The man finally looked at Barbara and said,
he's a keeper.
She said, oh no, we're not. This is a friend of mine, Jack. Barbara.
Hi, Barbara.
Hello, Jack,
Barbara said. Jack served his country with honor and distinction in Afghanistan, Chris said. Barbara gave the man a solemn nod as Chris opened the door and said, see you later, Jack. The homeless man gave them a thumbs up. As they entered the lobby, Barbara said,
I should have given him something.
Chris shook his head. Don't worry about it.
Drop a buck in his cup on the way out if you feel like it. They took the elevator to the 15th floor, walked to the end of a hall, and entered his apartment. Chris went straight to the kitchen.
Take the tour while I find some ice.
He shuffled things around in the freezer compartment of his refrigerator while Barbara admired the view from his apartment window.
If you look between those two buildings over on the left, he called out from the kitchen, you can see a small sliver of the East River.
I bet when they advertised this place, they touted the river view, she said,
one arm crossing her midsection so she could hold her elbow.
You guessed it. Allowed them to add another $200 a month to the rent, he said. When a boat goes by, it's like looking at it through a keyhole.
While the view was not spectacular, it was a decent apartment. Spacious enough living room. A sliding glass door that led to a balcony big enough for two chairs. A peek down the hallway showed three doors, so a bathroom and two bedrooms. Not bad. Barbara would have killed for an extra bedroom that she could have turned into an office instead of always using her kitchen table to do her work. The furnishings were modern, and there was the obligatory wall with the flat-screen TV, audio equipment, and shelves for speakers, CDs, DVDs, books, and a few framed snapshots. Barbara ran her finger across the spines of the books. She never went into a house without seeing what the residents read, or at least displayed. Valens's taste ran to mostly nonfiction, history, politics. He even had a copy of that sports star's memoir, the one Barbara had ghostwritten. Maybe I should autograph it, she thought. She stopped and looked at one of the photos. A young, grinning Chris, maybe 7 years old, standing between what she presumed were his mother and father, the three of them leaning up against a rusted minivan. It looked like a vacation shot, and whoever'd snapped it was one of those amateur photographers who thought you must show the entire person from shoes right up to their heads. All three were in cutoffs, short sleeves, and sneakers, and there was what looked like camping gear strapped to the roof racks. Everyone looked happy. You didn't need to vacation at the Ritz to have a good time. Barbara glanced into the kitchen. Sleek cupboards, small granite-topped island, Wolf stove with the red knobs, sub-zero fridge. If Valens had come from humble beginnings, he appeared to be doing okay now. Valens pointed to the small, round table tucked into the corner of the kitchen by the window. There were two open laptops with darkened screens sitting there.
Let me make some space, he said, closing them, setting one atop the other and moving them to the kitchen counter.
Sit, he ordered. Barbara sat. He brought over a bag of frozen vegetables from the freezer, set it on the table, and gently lifted Barbara's arm and rested her right elbow on it. Oriental stir fry, she said, glancing at the bag. So this is like Chinese medicine? She winced. Fuck, that's cold. She'd rolled her sleeve up, but the bag was too cold on bare skin. She rolled her sleeve down and put her elbow back on it.
I still think you should go to the hospital.
I'm not dying. She almost managed a grin. I'm not that bad. You tackle like a girl. What about your hand? Doesn't it need some frozen veggies too?
He waggled his fingers in the air. They work fine. He went back to the freezer. Hey, this might be better. He held up a pliable blue gel ice pack.
The veggies are doing the job, she said. He closed the freezer.
You want a coffee? I got a one-cup maker.
You never have company? She asked.
Valens ignored the question. Yes or no on the coffee?
Actually, just some water and some Tylenols if you've got them.
He opened one cupboard to get a glass and another to get a small bottle of pills. He filled the glass from the tap and shook out two pills onto the kitchen table. She popped the pills into her mouth and washed them down with her free hand.
I've yet to encounter a problem that can't be solved with drugs and or alcohol, she said.
So you want a beer with that, then?
She shook her head. Water's fine. She paused. Tell me about your friend.
Nothing to tell, really. Served his country, came back.
PTSD, couldn't hold a job, lost his family, no support, end of story. There's a million of them.
But you help him,
Barbara said. He shrugged. Not really. Not as much as I could or should. Barbara narrowed her eyes as she looked at him, as if intensifying her focus would provide some greater insight.
So, she said slowly.
Yeah? Chris looked at her with raised eyebrows.
You were following me, she said.
Nope.
You had to be.
He shook his head very slowly. You think you're that important?
Why are you dressed like this?
Like what?
Baseball cap? Leather jacket? Jeans? Give me a break. You didn't want to look like you did in the limo yesterday.
On my day off, Chris said, I lose the suit and tie.
It's Tuesday.
The mayor has weekend events. Sometimes I work Saturday or Sunday, so I get a day off midweek instead.
Not buying it, Barbara said.
Okay. So let's say I was following you, which I was not. This kind of blows my cover, doesn't it? Barbara considered that.
Maybe the whole thing was a setup, a way to gain my confidence, so you rescued me.
Yeah. I cleverly arranged for that truck to come along at just the right moment as you were crossing the street, and you helped immeasurably by staring at your phone the whole time like a complete and total idiot. Barbara bit her lower lip.
Okay. So where were you going if you weren't following me?
There's a bar up the street where I have lunch sometimes. He cast a suspicious glance her way. What are you doing in my neighborhood? How do I know you weren't nosing around up here looking for me?
Please, she said.
Let me ask you this, Chris said. Is this your routine when someone saves your life? Interrogate them? A simple thank you would do. Barbara was quiet for several seconds as though working up her nerve to say something nice.
Okay, she said slowly. Thanks. And I'm sorry you scraped your hand.
Stop gushing, he said. You're embarrassing me.
You could still have been following me, but had to do the right thing when I nearly bought it. Felt you had no choice. That's why you tried to take off without my seeing you.
The veggie's working, he asked. She lifted up her elbow momentarily.
I think a piece of frozen cauliflower is digging into a bone.
He got up, went to the freezer, and brought back the proper ice pack. As she set her elbow on it, he tossed the bag of frozen vegetables back in.
You got any real food here? She asked.
He opened the fridge compartment wide enough for her to see. It was nearly empty.
This could be my place, Barbara said. You don't get to the store much?
Valens shrugged.
Let me ask you something, Barbara said.
More questions about how I staged your near-death experience? She shook her head.
Sit down.
He did.
So, Headley. What exactly do you do for him? What's your title?
I was recently knighted, so you might want to call me Sir Valens.
Funny, I would have pegged you for the court jester.
I'm an assistant to the mayor. I assist. Barbara smiled.
In what ways do you assist?
Chris leaned in closer. Any way I can. Security, policy, implementation, research, whatever.
Security?
He nodded.
You got a conceal and carry license?
I'm sorry. Barbara rolled her eyes. She knew he knew what she was talking about.
Are you packing?
Did you seriously say, are you packing? Are we in a Scorsese movie?
Show me your gun,
Barbara said. First of all, Chris said, I am not going to answer that question. And if I were packing, which I am not saying I am, I wouldn't be doing it on my day off. Barbara sighed.
Fine. So you assist the mayor. So, following me around, that would fall into the category of assisting.
You're a one-trick pony.
Okay,
she said, switching gears.
Tell me about him.
Off the record?
Off the record. Cross my heart and hope to die.
Valens shrugged. He's an asshole.
I wouldn't call that a keen insight. A lot of us have figured that out.
But even if he is, you don't get how things work in the real world.
I think I've heard this speech before,
Barbara said. Chris said, nothing gets done in this town without cutting corners.
Cutting corners shouldn't mean rewarding people who donated to your campaign.
Did you ever get a job because you knew somebody? A friend who put in a word for you? Do you know anyone who hasn't somewhere along the line gotten a job that way, one hand washing the other?
It shouldn't work that way at City Hall.
Suppose right now you became mayor, or, I don't know, managing editor of the Times. Who would you bring in to help you run things? People you'd worked with in the past? People whose abilities and reputations you knew? People who'd supported you along the way that you wanted to help out in return? Or total strangers, so as not to look like you were practicing favoritism? And then those total strangers turn out to be total fuck-ups. She decided to go in another direction.
What's the deal between the mayor and Glover? Who hates who more?
Valens spoke slowly, as though choosing his words carefully. The father-son dynamic can be a complicated thing.
Diplomatic.
Glover never stops trying to impress his father. It's not easy.
Because Headley's hard to please, or the boy's just not up to it?
Bit of both. Barbara nodded.
Why are the feds involved in the elevator crashes?
Valens blinked. I think I just got whiplash there. We're done with Glover.
Is it Homeland?
What are you talking about?
At least one set of relatives who lost someone in yesterday's crash was told not to talk about it or ask questions. By a guy in a dark suit with a dark SUV who sounded like he was right out of Central Casting. Everything but the Ray-Bans.
I've got no idea, Chris said, so ask Homeland. What do you want to talk about next? It's like you've got this list in your head. You're checking things off. Barbara looked into his brown eyes for several seconds.
What's your story? Who are you? Where do you come from?
Grew up in Queens. Moved into Manhattan in my 20s.
What did your folks do?
Dad worked construction. Died when a beam landed on him. My mom was a traditional wife until he passed, and she went out to work for a couple of years. Her face softened.
Sorry.
He shrugged. I was 10 when my dad died.
College?
Chris shook his head. No money for that. Whenever I need to know how to do something, I find someone who already knows and learn from them. Did all kinds of jobs from the age of, like, 13. Even before then, I had an aunt who helped me as much as she could with money, but she wasn't rich or anything. Worked in a butcher shop, computer repair store. Did some security work in my 20s. Sometimes I'd be doing them all at once, finishing up one shift at one gig and heading off to the other. He smiled. I'm a quick study. Show me how to do something once, I'll know it forever.
So you never played college football, then? Where'd you learn to tackle?
She smiled. Tackling girls just comes natural.
How'd you connect with Headley?
Worked low level on a campaign, got discovered. Like a movie star. He shrugged. What about you?
What about me?
Chris moved in closer.
Why are you so angry?
She scowled.
I'm not angry.
Please. I've been reading you for years, he said. You are one pissed off bitch, and I mean that as a compliment. The best writing comes from outrage, right? You use words like a weapon. Barbara shifted her elbow on the ice pack.
It's not anger, she said defensively. I just don't like injustice and hypocrisy.
Nah, he said, shaking his head. It goes deeper. Something happened to you. Something changed you. What was it?
Don't psychoanalyze me, she said.
He studied her for several seconds. You think who you are doesn't come through in everything you write? I may not know your shoe size, but I know who you are.
And who's that?
Someone looking to settle a score, he said. Let's have a look at that arm. He gently took hold of her wrist with one hand, as though she might try to escape, while he lightly touched her elbow with the other. Barbara made no effort to stop him.
So, this bald thing you got going on, she said, looking at his scalp. You after the Dwayne Johnson look? You shave it, or did you lose your hair before your first prom?
I don't have money for combs and conditioner, he said, still holding her arm. They didn't say anything for several seconds.
I don't sleep with the enemy, Barbara said.
Did I ask?
No,
Barbara conceded.
Not yet.
I'm heading into kind of a busy week and don't think I could handle anything more than heavy petting. She appeared to be considering it, then glanced at her elbow.
And I do my best work with this arm, and until it mends.
She pushed back her chair and stood. She handed Chris the ice pack.
Gotta go.
Let me walk you out.
I can find my way.
He followed her as far as the door. She turned, went up slightly on her toes, and kissed him on the cheek.
Thanks for the oriental veggies.
My pleasure.
I know you were following me, she said.
He smiled. Then you won't be surprised the next time it happens. On her way out, she gave Jack a 10. 29. They had to walk up 27 floors. They couldn't be sure that the other elevators in the York Avenue building hadn't been sabotaged in any way, even though there was no evidence that they'd been fitted with pinhole cameras. Martin Fleck offered to save the mayor the hike, saying he could take video and email it to him. But Fleck had also set the hook, promising to show something significant to the mayor, and Headley wanted to see it for himself. I still hit the Stairmaster 4 times a week, the mayor said. So lead the way. Brian Cartland of Homeland was okay with making the climb as well, but Police Chief Annette Washington begged off, but not because she wasn't up to it. She had a meeting at One Police Plaza. In the lobby, Arla had found Glover and was going to tell him about the exchange she had just witnessed between the mayor and the boy, but she didn't have a chance. The sound of a text notification came from inside Glover's jacket. He looked at the phone to find a message from his father. On second floor, but on the move, get up here.
Gotta go, he said. You might as well head back to the office. The others should be back by now, and you can get started.
Arla was dismissed. Glover found the entrance to the stairwell and was just about to exit onto the second floor hallway when the fire door opened, and his father, Fleck, and Cartland entered. We're going up, Headley said.
How far?
Glover asked.
You'll see,
his father said. Fleck led the way, followed by the mayor, then Cartland, and finally Glover. Everyone except Glover was careful to pace himself, taking the stairs at a steady rate. Glover, however, in struggling to keep up, occasionally took the steps two at a time, which only tired him out even more, causing him to stop several times to catch his breath. Once they'd reached the 29th floor, Cartland said of the yet-to-be-seen Glover, "Shall we wait for your son, Mr. Mayor?" Headley had a hand on his chest, feeling the pounding inside.
"That really was a workout," he said. "You think you're in shape, but no, let's get started. Glover will get here when he gets here."
Fleck led them down a corridor around the corner from the elevators until they reached a locked green door marked Equipment Room, Keep Out. Fleck produced a key to open the door, and once he had, they heard the soft humming of machinery and cooling fans. Cartland and Headley followed him in. As the door was about to shut, a hand shot in to keep it open. A breathless Glover stepped into the room behind the others.
Good of you to join us, Glover, Headley said.
The room, about 30 feet square, was filled with several tall, locker-like units in the center that were constructed of green metal. Along one wall were the tops of the machines, massive pulleys that housed the belts and cables responsible for raising and lowering the elevators through the shafts. They were, at this time, idle, given that all the elevators were shut down. Attached to one of the locker units at eye level was a black box about the size of a thick paperback novel or an oversized TV remote.
"Whoa,"
said Glover, scanning the machinery like a wide-eyed kid.
"Never been in a room like this."
Fleck walked over to one of the green metal units and, with another key, opened one. Inside, from top to bottom, were countless wires and circuit panels. Lights flickered on and off while small digital readouts provided information. Hedley glanced at it all, clearly flummoxed by what any of it meant.
"This is the brains and the guts of the elevator system," Fleck told the other men.
He reached for the black box attached to the next unit and dislodged it. It had evidently been attached magnetically. It had a small screen at the top and several rows of small buttons below. A cable with a jack at the end dangled from the bottom. Fleck plugged it into one of the circuit boards and the screen came to life with a series of numbers and symbols.
"Okay," Fleck said. "I'm now, with this box, in control of the elevator system to this building. I can move them from floor to floor, open the doors and close them, send them straight to the bottom or the top. I can do any damn thing I want."
He continued,
"Before I can do any of this, of course, I have to punch in a slew of codes to establish an interface between this device and the elevator system. But if you know the codes, you're in business. And here's the thing."
At this point, he unplugged the unit and started tapping the various buttons with his index finger.
"If I'm outside the building, at home, or at my office, and if I want to do all these same functions, I can, as long as I have this box or one just like it with me. Admittedly, that's a little trickier because first I have to get through the entire building's security system to access the elevator system. But if I know those codes, and it would be easier to get them if I've already been in here to set things up, I'm in business. I can make this elevator do whatever I want, and I don't even have to be here. So if you're thinking of reviewing the surveillance tapes from the time of the event, well, that's not necessarily going to be of any help."
"Jesus," said Hedley.
"But the codes and everything, those can't be easy to crack."
"They aren't," Fleck agreed.
"But it can be done."
"So," Cartland said, "you'd either have to work in the elevator business and understand all this shit, or..."
"Know someone who did,"
said Glover, who had been watching intently. Hedley gave his son a dismissive look.
"Thanks, Glover. I think we'd all pretty much figured that part out."
To Fleck, he said,
"Or anyone who works for the city's elevator inspections division."
"Yes," said Fleck. Hedley looked at Cartland.
"What do you suggest?"
"Off the top," he said, "we need to get people checking every single elevator in the city, looking to see if a camera's been surreptitiously installed. So far, the two elevators where people have been killed have had that camera."
"Christ. How long could that take?"
Hedley asked Fleck.
70,000 elevators and roughly 140 inspectors," Fleck said. "Do the math, that's about 1,800 elevators per person. You figure maybe they can do half a dozen a day, and..."
"That's insane," Hedley said.
"But," Fleck said, "if we make this public, get every building maintenance team involved, and they do the inspections themselves, at least a simple visual, well, that would speed up the process."
Hedley looked back to Cartland.
"Go public."
Cartland's face was granite.
"We go public with this," Hedley said, "and let everyone in New York know that somebody may be fucking with the elevators, and they know that every time they get into one of these things, they're gambling with their lives."
"Pandemonium," said Glover.
"Yeah," said Cartland. "This is a vertical city. You got 8.5 million people afraid to go to work, terrified to ride the elevators in their own building."
The city will come to a fucking standstill, Headley said. Unless we can find the son of a bitch who's got one of those boxes there.
Yeah, said Cartland. And if this is, as we suspect, sabotage, we have to start asking why anyone would want to do this.
The terrorists need a reason?
Headley asked. This is a very sophisticated way to go about killing people.